So there's another lecture that I was looking at for this. I usually try to put in two lectures, partly to cover my depths, partly because my deepest fear is that I'll name a lecture and nobody will want to read it or be interested in it. So I put out two, figuring if you don't like one, you'll like the other. And the other one I picked was the Path to the Real Self chapter. It's confusing whether it's chapter 10 or 11. It depends on how you count through the chapters. And it's it talks about parents and images. Okay? And the reason I picked this to go with the transference lecture is the title of lecture 118 is Duality Through Illusion. And that kind of gives you a sense of what the lecture is about. The lecture is about trying to make a choice through the illusion that that choice is necessary. Just because one parent lives their life one way and one parent lives their life the other does not mean necessarily that you have to make a choice. But it can sure seem like that in a day-to-day life situation. And the day-to-day life situation is a dualistic way of looking at things. I have to choose whether to tell the truth or come up with a story. Okay? When we talk about the lecture on parents and images, it talks about how we, even if we're looking at one parent versus the other, we're probably not really looking at the actual parent. That it is very, very likely that we have created an image of what that parent is. So it kind of puts us three or four steps further into fantasy. Number one, we think we have to make a choice. We don't have to make a choice. And secondly, we're making a choice on perceptions that are not real. They're not true. So again, what these lectures are trying to give you is a sense that as adults, we sometimes treat the perceptions we had as children as if they were adult perceptions seen from a small body. But that's not what they were. What a child perceives is based upon what it knows. There was a lovely little BBC documentary about children, and it talked about the fact that when a parent is trying to get a child to be toilet trained, and a child will sometimes have a terrible fear of the toilet, and the parent doesn't understand it, the parent logically goes through, shows them the mechanism, you know, you explain over and over and over again, and the kid still acts like there's something terrible in this toilet and won't sit down. And at some point, a parent can lose patience and simply picks the kid up and plops it on the toilet and says, "You stay here until you're done." Okay? It's actually quite reasonable. At some point, you've got to go on, or as a parent, you feel you must just go on with life, and you can't take every fear the child has too extremely. What this little BBC documentary did was they talked about it from a child psychologist, obviously figured this out, from the child's point of view. And the child actually has a very strong perception that anything its body produces is theirs. They don't see it like we do. They don't see it as an objective thing, especially an objective dirty thing that needs to be gotten rid of. The kid sees this thing as a magical substance that came out of their body, and they're going, "Whoa, look at this!" And the parent says, "Put it in the toilet," and then the parent flushes the toilet, and the beautiful, wonderful thing goes away forever. And what the child psychologist pointed out was that to some extent, a child being placed on a toilet can have the feeling that if they slip in, and after all, they're kind of small, it could happen. If they slipped in and someone flushed, that they could disappear forever. This is not simply a sanitary device. This is a device that takes things away forever. And the child is being asked to sit on this thing totally naked, totally vulnerable, and put its tender, sensitive little parts within reach of this water monster. This is a perception that we don't have as adults. We have forgotten. We later learned the value of toilets, and we later learned the value, and all these learnings that we have are so strong that we have a difficult time going back to the place where we saw this thing as sucking the life force out of the universe. If something that simple can be so difficult for us to reconstruct from that tender, ignorant child's point of view, imagine all the other things that we're handed, that we have to handle as we are being groomed to enter society and become a working member of society. Imagine all the contradictions that we're being handed that adults have resolved, and they're simply handing them to us and say, here, do this because it's right. And we do not have the tools and the skills to verbalize, much less conceive of, what our objections might be. So when we look at transference, it is really important for us to get that when we made our decisions, when we perceived our parents, when we started on some of these unconscious journeys, we were starting from a place of profound ignorance where we were desperately trying to make the world make sense. And sometimes we put round pegs in square holes.
Jan?
Yeah.
Using that example of a toilet situation there, when you finally grow up and you realize that it's not dangerous like you felt it was before, does that still mean that your original experience there has some effect in your unconscious?
It could. But sometimes the bigger damage is that you gave up your fear, that you never resolved it. So it's not so much the fear itself is an issue, but how many of those fears you covered up. Now I'm going to go back to the archaeologist analogy, okay? Imagine that you've got... I don't know how to do this. But imagine you've got worms. Let's be kids around this. Imagine that you've got worms, and they're alive and wiggling, and you don't know what to do with them. So you keep pouring plaster on them. Okay? And when you pour plaster on them, the problem with the wiggling seems to stop. Okay? But the worm's probably going to die. And there wasn't anything wrong with the worm in the first place, except it was wiggling and you didn't know what to do with it. So a kid might pour plaster on a worm, and then there's another worm and they pour plaster on it, and another, and they pour... So pretty soon they've got this box of plaster with a whole bunch of hidden wiggly worms, or more likely, dead, decaying yuck. Okay? There are other ways to deal with live wiggly worms. You can put them out in the garden. You can get rid of the wiggly, squirmy thing by planting it back in the earth. There are a lot of different solutions. But a child might find one solution that seems to get rid of the symptoms. And a child isn't responsible for having to worry about the environment or the extinction of this worm species. There's a lot of things kids don't have to worry about. They just need to stop the worm from wiggling. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If we do that in our psyche, can you see where we're actually building the equivalent of scar tissue in there? And there's a positive intent. Somebody says, don't be scared. Well, don't be scared doesn't resolve the fear. So we park it someplace. That one single fear by itself is not going to probably be a serious issue. What we're talking about here is a pattern of not dealing with our fears and parking them someplace. If you have a pattern of that where every time you get anxious, you come up with a solution and it sounds as if the problem doesn't exist anymore. As an adult, you're actually living on a very, very thick layer of anxiety. Okay? And what we're talking about here is everybody does that. It's not a huge drama. But if it becomes a drama, if it becomes a place in your life that doesn't work, now we need to start digging this up. We need to start exploring this and finding out what's going on. So we don't want to get hysterical about one minor fear. Okay? But if you have continually buried fears, they don't go away, they add up. But a particular fear about a particular situation is almost never a life event. It's just not going to become a not going to create a dysfunctional adult. It's the patterns that create dysfunctional adults. Does that answer your question?
You can, at the time, at the present moment, perceive a particular thing as a dysfunction, but trying to remember where it all started seems to be pretty difficult.
You don't necessarily have to remember where it started. What you need to do is figure out what the mechanism is that happens when you deal with it today. Okay? So if your way of dealing with fear is to suppress it, you have a way of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
The work is about uncovering that, of making that conscious. Because once it's conscious, then you can actively see if you can make other choices. As you make other choices, you will find that you may find a different style of dealing with it that works for you. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be perfect. There is not a perfect way of dealing with conflicting realities. But there is a way where you feel comfortable with yourself, where you don't feel anxious about your decisions, and where you have a deeper understanding of your own personality and your own needs. And we work with transference because what we're saying is, what the lecturer is saying is that without you realizing it, a very, very large number of your character and personality mechanisms relate all the way back to your childhood and come from how you dealt with childhood situations. Now again, if you're happy with that, leave it alone. We're only talking about areas where you are not happy with how your life is going, where you are not happy with the decisions that you are making, where you are not happy with the levels of anxiety that you feel in you, where you feel out of integrity, where you feel that you are not expressing yourself honestly, where you may have other personality elements that were never developed. By tracking back to your childhood, as far as you can, and noticing why you might have suppressed some elements of your personality to prevent disharmony in the home, to gain love and approval, to dodge conflict, or to make yourself look good. All these different kinds of reasons could be reasons why you stressed one part of your personality and held the other back. As an adult, what happens to us is we're not happy. We feel these areas of undeveloped personality. And we're dying to express them. We want to exercise more of who we are. And we become dissatisfied as life goes on with the areas of us that have been allowed to atrophy. or the areas in us that are performing in ways that do not ring true to us. So the work in working with spiritual discipline is not only to honor the humanity of who we are, but to go even deeper. I want to speak to that for a few minutes. That in the spiritual transference, again, if we go back and say we picked our parents because this particular society, culture, these choice of parents, the extended family, the gene pool that we got born into, is going to give us a certain reality to grow up in that is going to emphasize, it's going to, like a blacksmith, it's going to beat some things into us. Okay? From a spiritual perspective, what we're doing is we're trying to manifest in a condensed fashion something that we want to work on. And from a transference perspective, where you've got the parents holding both sides, in spiritual transference, what you may have is a place where you are hiding something because you really feel that God, being so perfect and wonderful, would look down at you for who you are. Now, that's transference, because most of us do not know what the mind of God feels like. So we don't even know what our spirit and our soul feels and thinks. We think we do. But anybody who talks to me, well, I shouldn't say that because I do talk to ghostly things sometimes. Let me rephrase that. When another human being talks to me and I talk back, I am talking from my human consciousness. I'm not talking from my God self all the time, every once in a while for a short period perhaps. But as a general rule, I'm talking from my human consciousness, from my ego, from the person I am in this incarnation. If you choose to think that there's only one incarnation, that's great. Same rules apply. So when I speak on the phone right now, from a spiritual perspective, I believe that I am bigger, kinder, more loving, and more wise than the person speaking on the phone. I certainly don't think I'm less than the person speaking on the phone to you right now. How much bigger I am, I don't know. But I can't really know that. And I can't know that because I'm here. So from here, I'm limited. And as a human being, what we do is we anthropomorphize dogs. We anthropomorph, meaning we give it the characteristics of being a human being. We anthropomorphize the wind. We take everything in our universe and understand it in terms of human thought patterns, human feelings, human proclivities. When the other thing itself may not have a clue what we're talking about. So the wind may just blow. And when we say, I'll bet you the wind blows because it feels good, we're already making an assumption. From a human standpoint, that's why we'd blow. We don't really know why the wind blows. For the same reason, we do not know the mind of God. But in our attempt to want to understand, in our desire for development and in our desire to be worthy of spirit, we will reach out and we will look at God and we will see in God human characteristics. And one of the human characteristics is to disown others or to not think highly of them, or to be angry. So there are a lot of, specifically in the question and answer lectures, there are references to where the Bible does speak the truth, and I really don't want to get into it because I respect people. Some people believe in the Bible as written, and I wish to respect their beliefs. But there is a place where the Bible as written may express deeper truths in simplistic terms. So when the Bible says God was angry, what does that mean? Does God really get angry, or does God do something that to a human being, the closest descriptive term we have for it is anger? But once we put that word on it, it just goes forward from there. If God is angry, then we need to make him unangry. If God is disappointed, we need to step up to the plate and make up for whatever it is we did to make God disappointed.
And the other one, God is a jealous God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a personal decision as to how you perceive God, but what I'm saying is that from a human perspective, the perceptions you use to try to understand the Creator are going from low to high. It's going from the human mind into a mind that's probably a bit more advanced than ours. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the likelihood is you're going to get it wrong. The likelihood is you're going to try to make God fit into a human arena rather than you really being able to fit into a larger arena. So when we look at transference, spiritual transference onto God, if we think that we have disappointed God, that's, let's go with that, but that would be a misunderstanding of the situation. But if we believe that on a spiritual level, then we might feel that we had something that needed to be resolved that may not need to be resolved. And so we would come to earth with this belief, there's something wrong with me. God is angry. I must make God unangry, or he will not love me, or he will destroy the world. And we've got a forcing current. We've got an urge. We've got a drive. One of the things that we may be here on earth to learn is that God isn't angry. That perhaps God has a more generous view of our imperfections than we do. And one of the spiritual tasks some of us may be dealing with on this planet is to really embrace the simple imperfections of being in flesh. Now, what form would that take? The stories are endless. I hope you can imagine the whole different scenario of stories for which the like Aesop's fables, the moral would be, there's nothing wrong with your imperfections. Just hold faith. Just have positive intent. Just love. Just tell the truth, and you'll be fine. But to really learn that and absorb it and really get it, we need to go beyond the intellect. So there's a phrase that I'm looking for here that was particularly beautiful in its elegance. Right. So, this is from a thing I found on the internet by a psychotherapist, and I put it in the notes and gave her credit. And it says, what's important to understand is that simple awareness of the transference is only halfway to healing. To change your internal reactions, the brain needs to experience the transference in the present moment. This provides an opportunity for the brain to rewire itself over the emotional issue. To benefit most from the phenomenon of transference, it is essential that you be present with your feelings. To access your right brain, the seat of your emotions, a verbal discussion largely divorced from your emotional reactions will compromise your chances for real change, embodied change. What this might look like in a session, and she's talking about psychotherapy, but this is also what Pathwork sessions and Pathwork groups and workshops are designed to do. What this might look like in a session is taking the risk of letting your therapist or leader or partner know your personal reactions or feelings towards him or her. In other words, of addressing the person honestly and at the same time acknowledging consciously, I remember this. This is just like my mom and dad. Oh, my goodness. These feelings have gone on all my life. So that the feelings are real and they are re-experienced and honored. But the cognitive connections allow you to become more free of 1-2 cause-effect and to see a greater range of possibility. And the last line is in her article was very key. Knowing logically does not change feelings. And that's where the Pathwork lectures, as powerful as they are, as brilliant as I have found them, and I have never seen anything with the wisdom that the Pathwork lectures have, they still need to be brought to life. They still need for these concepts and for these words and these lovely phrases of acceptance that the guide offers to us, they still need to be brought to us in the places where we have strong feelings, so that we, again, using the phrase, which can be unfortunate sometimes, I find it useful, but sometimes other people don't, we are rewiring. We are building new pathways in our mind. We are building new possibilities. I don't have to be honest all the time to be a good person. I can shade the truth for the sake of not hurting somebody's feeling or alarming them and still be a person of integrity. Or I will chance someone's momentary anger, and instead of covering up my reality to make it palatable for them, I will be more truthful to who I am, what I feel and what I think, and I will let the chips fall where they may.
That's passive.
No, I think that that's active.
That's what I said, less passive, yeah.
Right, yes, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. So in other words, I will take the chance to tell the truth. I know that the other person may not have heard the full truth from me, and they may be upset or alarmed or irritated. But in the long run, we're both going to be better off if I tell the truth. I've been spending way too many years telling white lies, trying to keep you calm and happy. What I'm saying is there's an argument on both sides. There's an argument for not telling the harsh truth every chance you get, as if that was innately some superior way of behaving. And there's also an argument for being honest and understanding that it will irritate or upset people sometimes. It's not the end of the world. But either way, if you're hiding your truth or shoving your truth, this by itself is not in integrity. So the invitation here is to find a softer, gentler place of balance. So for some people, less passive. For some people, more passive, but it's not really more passive, it's less active. So if you think of this as a rainbow, where the colors are not marked off by bands, or dark lines. There's a spectrum here. Okay, there's more. There are more choices than we normally give ourselves. And to be able to explore that, if you think you need to be firmly red, you may need to explore orange or purple. And then the truth may be, I like red. I was happy where I started from. But you see, the difference is now you know. Now you've explored the other colors. And you may want to wander over and take a little sip of yellow before you completely dedicate your life to red. And that's sometimes what our lives are about. We go places not so much because we're supposed to go there, but to basically learn that that's not what we thought it was. And then and only then we're able to let go. Again, going back to that lovely phrase, knowing logically does not change feelings. But going through life and expressing and experimenting and experiencing, getting things, giving things away, losing things, telling the truth, seeing what happens, telling a lie, seeing what that happens. The whole idea with life is to learn. And if you learn, then you'll wind up, it's like a chess piece. You'll be at some place on the chessboard at the end of the game, but the actual position on the chessboard may matter far less than we realize. What may be much, much more important is that we are at peace with some part of us that we were not at peace with before. So are there any other questions or places you'd like me to go?
I did have another thought that I wanted to run past you with regard to this transference and see if it makes any sense. There's one word that I came across in that path of the real self, mm-hmm. and its dependency, the idea of children being dependent on their parents, mm-hmm. and as they mature, they transfer that sense of or need for dependency on other externals, mm-hmm. and maybe even symbols, you know, that become false idols that should show us our inner world or divinity, uh-huh. but we use that as the answer and depend on the symbols rather than what the symbols are trying to tell us.
Uh-huh.
Is that transference?
To some degree it is, in that when the guide talks about dependence the way you in the way you're describing it, or the part you're talking about, this is a place where a child wants to stay a child. So in other words, if we were felt dependent on our parents, but we felt that was safe, we may, going back to the title of these lectures, which is sometimes really useful, Duality Through Illusion, if we are happy with dependence, we may decide that dependence is safe and therefore independence is not safe. So we wind up searching for new umbrellas to hide under.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And that's our life quest. I'll hide in the marriage. I'll hide in the job.
Other things to be dependent on?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Okay? That's assuming that we felt safe.
Right.
We may also, besides feeling safe, we may have felt relieved. Being relieved is different from feeling safe. So in other words, a child may feel that they're not capable of being an adult. So it's not that dependency feels safe, but it's a hiding place. and the result would be the same. They would look throughout their life for places they could hide. A job where they were simply told what to do, and if they did it, nobody argued with them. Where they were not asked to be independent. They were not asked to take risks. They were not asked to stand up. They might choose a relationship where the other person made all the decisions. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a factor of safety, could be a factor of not wanting to grow up. Not because it was unsafe, but because it's too much work, and we don't like it, and we don't want to go through the gauntlet of being wrong. We'd rather sit back here and take the easy route. Okay?
So that becomes a belief system, huh?
Yep. Now, if you've got that kind of belief system, the chances are it was formed back when you were a kid. The dependency was an option. So one or the other parent very likely enjoyed your being dependent and encouraged it. It can be subtle, but it's still there. In fact, the more subtle it is, the harder this work is.
And the other parent might be the antithesis of that.
Yes. So I say this, and it's meant to be a compliment to the kind of people that I run into, the kind of people I talk to, the kind of people who bother to get on the phone or an email to me, is that I find that the people that I work with are dealing with some very refined levels of self-analysis and self-work. And sometimes there's a tendency, and I speak from my personal experience, when I was doing this kind of work, and I was in a group of 10 people, it seemed to me like one kid got beaten by their parents and the other kid got adopted out, and this other, they had all these dramatic stories. And I felt embarrassed because I didn't honestly feel like I had something where I could point a finger and say, this was wrong. This happened to me as a child and this was wrong, and I feel rage about it. I want to work on my rage. Because I had internalized some very subtle stuff when I was a kid. And I thought that bringing that out was wrong. So the people I work with, in my experience, and maybe that's just because I draw to me people that, like me, did not find it easy to express themselves when they were little and wound up, to some extent, being crippled the same way throughout their life, they're not wanting to do something dramatic per se. They're feeling a sense of unease. They're feeling a mild dependency. They're feeling that there's some reason they can't get out in the world. They can't take a managerial job. They can't make choices that are confrontive to others. And in this way, there can be a subtle place where they're hiding under this umbrella. And they're just very, very nervous about being exposed. And sometimes this is for good reason. It's a catch-22. If you've never expressed yourself, you have no experience doing that, and that part of you isn't well developed, then when you bring it out later, it's still not well developed. So the joke version that I use is that if you have a very, very angry child, and you lock them in the closet, and you open the closet 20 years later, the chances of a well-developed and integrated human being walking out of that closet are slim. Okay? What's going to walk out of that closet is a very dirty, very angry, very distorted human being. And if you take that analogy in, the parts of us that we did not develop because we were cowardly, because we were afraid, because our parents shamed us, because, you know, a thousand reasons, whatever we chose not to develop and held back on, when we're 30, 40, 50 years old and we bring that out, it's not developed. And it's even more embarrassing to bring that out now than it was when we were five. Now, everyone I deal with has developed parts of their personalities. Those are the parts that came out, met the world, went back and forth, got dusted off, got cleaned up, got adjusted, got modulated. And those are the functional parts of our personality. But it is my experience that people who work with the Pathwork Lectures, people who work on subtle levels of development, are asking that relatively small but crucial parts of themselves that got left behind be allowed to develop. So when you're working down at that microscopic level sometimes, that's where the subtleties of transference, the subtleties of your parents as an image rather than who they really were. These are all tools by which you can begin to see the places where you were not fully in reality, the places where you ducked, the places where you didn't know what to do, so you didn't do anything. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we work. And sometimes there's not high drama to this. But that urge, that little voice that keeps people coming back, that makes them go to the website and pull down lectures and surf the internet looking for information, this is our eros. This is our positive intent. This is the part of us that says there's more out there and I want it. So again, I really feel that I've wandered quite a ways afield from normal transference. I hope it's useful, what we've gone through.
Well, I probably led you astray with my questions.
Well, questions are really, really important. The questions are real. Okay? Sometimes theory is nice, which is why it works fairly well for a two-hour teleconference. But the real work is in the personal. It's in our feelings and our experiences and the precise way our distortions have evolved over time. So if there's anybody else still on the line, and sometimes there's not, if there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, we may be done a few minutes early this time.
Jen?
Yes.
Hello, it's Melita here.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome, Melita.
Thank you. As you're talking, this is sort of, how can I explain? I'm actually looking at these things from a perspective of my daughter who's six.
Mm-hmm.
And I notice this more often in her, what she's going through.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to noticing it in myself.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if there's something that she really, really wants to do or have, and I say no to that,
mm-hmm.
I get an immediate, literally stomping of the feet and a rage that comes
uh-huh.
up. I can see it happening in her, yet the words do not come out.
Okay.
I can see it being lodged in her throat,
mm-hmm.
and I can see the inability for this expression and the turmoil that she goes through at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I so feel for her at that moment, yet I'm unable to assist her in expressing herself.
Okay.
And I feel quite deficient in that area to understand what at that moment is going through. I mean, in a way I do, yet I feel I don't have the tools to help alleviate that pressure that she's feeling at that moment. And I so wish that I could do something. Depending on my state at that moment in time, whether or not I am restless time, if I have the moment to stop and think for myself, sometimes I am able to actually control myself in not reacting in a negative way towards that.
Mm-hmm.
And other times it's really, really difficult where I actually escalate the situation instead of dampening it.
Okay.
But what these lectures are actually helping me with is at least to know that this thing is happening and to look out for them in myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding it really, really helpful in that sense.
So the first thing that I would point out is how positive it is that you notice your daughter's struggle at all. For a lot of us, and I say this in a teasing way, because what I want to say is for a lot of us that would have been enough, but that's not true, because if we'd gotten that, we'd have asked for more, okay?
Yeah.
But it's a beginning, and a lot of us never even got that. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like taking baby steps. I want to acknowledge that you see her struggle, and that that is not minor. That's big. That's a gift. And please understand that I'm just teasing this through as a teleconference, so I may say things that don't work. Just throw them away afterwards. Not a problem. But one of the places you might be able to start is to name that for her, so that she knows you see her. What I'm suggesting is that you may not know how to progress and how to go. You may not know at this moment how to raise your daughter. Okay? Number one, you're still learning. And after you learn with her, if you had another child, they'd be another story. So you never get it right. Okay? Every child is a work of art. But it's no small step to simply imagine with another adult. If they were at a loss for words, but you could see that they had a lot to say. Imagine with another adult if you said, I'm noticing that you may have a lot to say, even though you're not saying anything. And I just want to let you know that I don't know how to help, but I see your struggle. That can be a wonderful moment. You don't have to know what to do. You don't have to have an answer. And what I'm suggesting is take what you've got. You've already got some insight. Use it. And if you think that a six-year-old can't understand the subtleties of I see you, try it. You'd be surprised. It's a very gratifying thing for an adult to see us and not tell us what's going on in our head and what to do about it. It can be a freeing moment to realize, I don't know what to do and my mom doesn't know what to do, but she says it's okay to not know what to do. Gosh. Can you see where, without knowing what to do, you can help your daughter become more human? Because the truth is, a lot of us don't know what to do. To this day, a lot of us don't know what to do. We fake it. How about helping your daughter become a more honest person? How about laying some groundwork where your daughter can be the one person in the room in charge of a company or a government who's willing to say, maybe we don't have the answer yet. Maybe we need to sit with it. That's a magnificent leadership quality. And it comes from sometimes a moment that simple. If you listen to people's biographies, when they talk about their parents, they talk about moments like that. They talk about moments when they didn't know what to do and their parent put an arm around their shoulder and said, it's okay. It'll come to you. Now I heard you say there was a list, dum 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 dum. But when you address A, B does not happen exactly the same way. Okay? And this is where we need to have faith. This is where we need to not say, but it's always A, B, C, D, E, F, and then there's the tantrum. Well, that has been how it's been. But if we do something different at A, there is a possibility that things won't go in that same pattern.
Yeah. It's happened like that
right.
Sometimes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And as adults, it's our job to see those subtle shifts and say, we made some headway here.
Mm.
And next time, maybe we'll make more. Isn't that what adults are supposed to do? See from a greater perspective that just because you didn't get there today doesn't mean you failed? So in terms of transference, your work may be to look back and see where you were not greeted by your parents in this way, and that's why you don't have the answers for your daughter.
Yeah, it feels like I'm gagged.
That's okay. Like go back and look without blame.
Mm.
Without blame. These were two people struggling to figure their daughter out. And they did not have the internet. They did not have psychology. They did not have pathwork lectures. They had older books, simpler books, common wisdom that may not have been as enlightened as the materials that are available to more of us today. And I'm trying to couch these in very, very gentle ways because 200 years ago, you can be a brilliant parent, and 3 days ago, you can be terrible. It's not a matter of now versus them, then. But when you go back, be generous. Go back with love. And that's where I find that spirituality really helps, because from a spiritual perspective, they gave us what we asked them to give us. And they gave it to us because they were distorted in certain ways, and we knew that when we came here. We relied upon their distortions to help with our task. So to some level, say thank you, but finish unwrapping the present. Find out what they gave you. They gave you some positives and they gave you some negatives. The positives you get to keep, okay?
Mm.
The negatives you may need to work on a little bit.
Mm. Yeah.
And they can become positive qualities. They may just simply be not well developed yet. They may simply be in distortion. But an understanding of distortion may be all you need to support your daughter as she tries to do the very same thing you tried to do. I wish I had been as wise and loving a parent when I was 20 as I could be today. And I think that's where the lolly you get is being grandma. Because you get to do it again, only you're much, 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 much smarter. And you can show the world how well you've learned your lesson.
Is okay? That Wendy that asked that question?
Well, She doesn't have to identify herself, but no.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for asking it, because that was a good thing.
So take that, perhaps, Harry, as an answer to your question. All the questions are really important, because the questions come from us in our particular circumstances, and they have far more value than simple concept. Concepts are a starting point. They give us a room to work in. They give us some materials to work with. But it's our interaction with other human beings. That's what matters. So that kind of takes care of the time issue. Is there anybody else who'd like to say hi who came on late? Because we were kind of slow starting, and I went ahead and started before we had too many people.
Areli, Jan.
I beg your pardon?
Areli.
Areli. Welcome, Areli.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. Well, you're always welcome, whether or not you identify yourselves. Very grateful to have you. And thank you very much for spending time working together. So thank you all.
Thank you, Jan.
Thanks, Jan.
Thank you,
everyone. Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.